On with the show.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Voices of Misery podcast, and you guys are in for a special treat today, and I am very excited. When this email came through from a former guest of the show, you guys know her, Jennifer Margulis, extremely great interview. She came on the show a couple of years back during the height of COVID. Keep in touch, you know, here and there. Every so often, every few months, we exchange an email, and she sent me one. She's like, you got to check this lady out. Perfect for the show. Great content matter. Her name is Jenny Glick. She's a psychologist, sex therapist. You're going to love her. And you know what? I can't do you any justice, Jennifer. How the heck are you doing? Describe a little bit about yourself to the audience. Let us know who you are and what's going on.
Yeah, so good to be here. Such a privilege and so fun. I know what rich conversations you have. So thank you so much for having me in today. So my name's Jenny Glick, and I'm a marriage, family, child therapist. I'm also a certified sex therapist gone rogue. So I've worn all the credentials. I have 12 letters behind my name. Done the typical thing for many years, and then I decided to leave the regular space of marriage counseling because I saw, honestly, that a lot of it doesn't work. And I created a different way of working with people that requires 100% radical responsibility for each person rather than trying to fix your marriage. Each person is 100% accountable for how they show up in the relationship with what they believe, what they say, what they think, what they do. And shocker, marriages change, right? They either heal or they dissolve, but it's a much more organic process. And it's not a process that requires people to be in this tug of war, you know, which is what I saw for years and years and years. People would come in, park themselves on my couch and argue, want me to be judge and jury for how it was that the other person wasn't measuring up to what it is that they wanted to happen in their marriage. So that's what I do. I also have realized, and you might be particularly interested in this, so I have a master's degree, one of my many, in women's studies. And, you know, in the last few years, I've really woken up to, I think feminism was a big psyop. I think it has not helped women. I think it has not helped marriage. I think, if anything, it has bound us to needing to have it all and do it all, when most women, I don't want it all. Like, yeah. Thank you very much. I just want my little corner and I'd be perfectly happy. So that's a little bit about what I do. I'm also writing a book called The Grown-Ass Woman's Guide to Marriage. And it's really, you know, a book that could be called How to Unbitch Yourself, because we have, I think, taken empowerment to being bitchy in relationship and in many aspects of the world. So that's my somewhat controversial perspective. Back to you.
Well, I cannot wait to dive into all this. And this is perfect for our audience. I mean, we did some studies. We got some feedback from our publisher, Podbean, that, you know, our audience is primarily female between the ages of like 35 to 50, I guess, would be our demographic. So this is going to be a great conversation. And I'm excited to learn some stuff today.
Good, good. Yeah, I'm glad. So where do you want me to start?
Oh, I know where we're starting here, because right before we actually hit the record button, you dropped a little tidbit that I didn't catch in research here. And you told me that you belong to a cult. So I'll let you take it from there.
Yeah. So many years ago, I was in a cult. And part of why this conversation came up between the two of us before he hit record is I made a submission for an anthology that's going to be published soon about four quote unquote conspiracy theorists. It's kind of it's a la chicken soup for the soul for conspiracy theorists. And my submission that I called it How Being in a Cult Prepared Me for COVID. So, you know, I have been a liberal and identified as a liberal my entire life until 4 years ago when I lost any allegiance to anything and was really a bleeding heart good do-gooder. You know, I had a degree, master's degree in women's studies, master's degree in therapy, read the New York Times, listened to NPR, really was trying to help others get a leg up in the world, doing all the right things, and also a spiritual seeker. And I found a group of people who were like me, who wanted to do good in the world. And it was all around spirituality and psychological reflection. And so I started attending some of their meetings. We actually left the city that we're living in at the time and moved to Denver in order to be closer to what was called the Order House. And I loved it. I loved the commitment to kindness, to love, to goodwill, to being aware of your thoughts, to helping others, all of those things. But as I moved from community member to student to initiate, so once I started training to be a minister in the organization, I started to sniff out that something was afoot. And actually, I sort of knew the grumblings of it. And what happened was one night before bed, I said to my husband, "Hey, hon, I just Googled, how do I know if I'm in a cult?" And he said to me, "Babe, if you have to Google, how do I know if I'm in a cult? You're in a cult." Which I thought should have been the result that Google gave me, right? Yeah. But it wasn't. But, you know, part of what happens, and I'll be straight with you, I think that, I mean, cults are just, cultures are cults that are bigger, right? Like our culture is a cult. Like it's all about member size. And so there are a lot of things in our particular culture in the US that we believe, we, whatever the capital we is nowadays, and we believe those things because we went from a small group of what would have been considered a cult to a much larger culture, right? And so I use the word cult, and I know it has a lot of power, and
yeah,
it brings up ideas of, you know, people offing themselves wearing white tennis shoes, you know, those kinds of things. But but honestly, lots of subgroups are cults, and we come together often because 80% of what cults teach are really good. It's about, you know, serving others or spiritual growth or what have you. But what can happen, just like in any group, is authoritarianism starts coming into play. Questioners being shamed for questioning, right? Yeah. If you do start questioning, and this was the link that, you know, really woke me up, and what I was watching in March 2020 was, as I was questioning things, I was being shamed by the people around me, and the remedy for my questions was to return to the dogma of the truth of the group, right? Like there's no opportunity. Like any question, you mean regarding COVID or regarding being in the cult?
Well, like what kind of questions were you asking them that were immediately getting shut down? Because I know information was extremely protected during this time frame where you could only ask certain things, you couldn't ask other things. What were you kind of like crossing the line with them
by asking? Yeah. And so in March 2020, I just want to make sure that's what we're talking about. Yeah. So for at that time, actually, my husband, who was in medicine, he's a physician assistant at the time, we were reading the New York Times, and he was reading the front page where there were stories about like 17-year-old has died of COVID. And because he used to be part of Grand Rounds in the medical community, he was like, "Wait a minute, you don't talk about a 17-year-old dying of something that's the flu unless you want to scare people. Like, why are they talking about this on the front page of a newspaper? Like, this is what's considered in medicine a unicorn, right? Like, that's not something typical that people." So asking the questions of like, why are we trying to scare people? You know, my husband trained before family practice in peds, and his training was all about, you want to help the parent feel safe. You know, you don't want the parent to be panicked. If your kid is sick, your kid's going to get well. Right? Your kid's body is strong. And the last thing we want is a freaked out parent. And so asking questions like, wait a minute, if we have spent, you know, all these years in the medical community trying to reassure parents, why are we trying to scare them now? Right? So that question, that doesn't make any sense to scare a parent, because a freaked out parent, you know, in my experience, will over-medicate a child or make poor decisions or not be able to really read their symptoms because we're worried, right? Because we don't trust that their body's going to get over it, which is what many of us as parents, you know, what I did with my son when he was little. It's like, you have a fever, you're going to get fine. Go to bed, have some chicken soup, lay down, get off, you know, your phone, you'll be fine, right? Yeah. So those kinds of questions, the questions, we were actually living in Mexico during that time. We'd moved in 2019. So we were living in a little village in Mexico where it is standard protocol to have ivermectin on your medicine shelf because there's dengue fever. And so when I was calling my friends, April 2020, and, you know, having conversations like many of us were back then, and was saying, you know, in Chiapas, which is in a state in Mexico, they were actually handing out ivermectin, I think by August of 2020. And so they eradicated COVID early, early on in Mexico. And many people in my community of May and June 2020 were taking ivermectin prophylactically every week because we knew it was a safe medication. And we had it on our shelves in case you started having, you know, intense fevers. You knew that you could have dengue fever, and that's what would be prescribed. And so when I was sharing some of that information with some of my friends in the U.S., I got the kind of pushback that I'm sure you and maybe some of your listeners got too. It was like I just, you know, declared that I was the Antichrist or something.
Oh yeah. Sounds familiar.
It was pretty intense. And, you know, as someone who's has spent her life as kind of a do-gooder and like a liberal and open and affirming and celebrate diversity, I was like, where the hell did celebrate diversity just go? Like, what about the diversity of my perspective? You know, like I'm just bringing a different perspective to my group that, I thought was so open and affirming, but wasn't, and not certainly not to me. Yeah.
Now the thing about liberalism is to me, it's like when I hear a liberal talk, it's like they always have their heart at the forefront. It's like, hey, we want everyone to be together. We want everyone to be happy. We want togetherness and all this other stuff. Right. But the implementation behind these practices is what really makes them look insane. And the fact that you could even question COVID-19 and, you know, proven therapeutic like ivermectin, Nobel Prize winning ivermectin. I mean, like now we're just rehashing things that people have been saying now for the past few years about it.
Yeah, right.
All of a sudden now we can openly talk about this, but back then we couldn't. So it's just like, you know, the constant misinformation. I can understand why you would change, you know, from liberalism.
Oh.
Is that the main thing that did it for you? Was just the COVID? Just basically like, hey, we're not going to talk about this. You're not allowed.
You know, living outside of the U.S. Was a huge eye-opener for me. And I've traveled some as a young person. So I'm 50. And so in my 20s, I traveled, you know, we spent some time in Latin America, but I'd never lived in another country. So living in another country for 2 years, by choice, because we just decided to sell everything and move for fun, it really opened my eyes to how narrow my perspective was as what I used to, you know, identify as a liberal American. I honest to goodness thought I knew best. I really did. And I thought everybody else was stupid. I really did. I thought if they could just wake up and see it the way I see it, right? Things would be so much better. And so there's such value for me in recognizing that through higher education, the way that, I mean, I don't know that I would use the word brainwash, but maybe I should, I don't know. But the real particular perspective, right? That was like the only perspective. And then in the cult, you know, it's the same sort of thing. If you have any sort of skepticism or if you want to ask something outside of the regular dogma, then you're going to be exiled. You're going to be seen as stupid or not as well-versed as everyone else. And the only remedy is to come back into the fold, right? By re-indoctrinating yourself with the condoned information. And so the inability of, you know, some places, I don't want to make grand sweeping judgments about institutions, but some places being unavailable to, you know, question their own selves. If you don't have people around you who are going to question your own tomfoolery, you know, we're going to be in trouble. We're going to be in trouble, you know?
Well, they removed the checks and balances is what happened because you had some doctors were saying, hey, this is the greatest vaccine of all time. And you have other doctors saying, no, this thing is deadly. And you got some in the middle saying, hey, let's just let people choose for themselves. And you had to be in one of those three baskets.
Yeah.
And that is the number one rule when it comes to cult behavior is isolation.
Yes.
Hey,
isolation. Yes.
You got to stay here. You can't even talk to them. Don't talk to them. Don't share ideas, because if you do that, you can't hang out with us. You can't sit at the cool kids table anymore. It's absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, it's the single solution. And that's what I identified early on, you know, even before they rolled out the vaccines, when I was seeing the single solution was staying at home. You know, the single solution now is vaccine, and there's no other option. And it literally made the hairs on the back of my neck stand up, knowing, watching what was happening, because I'd been through it and I'd seen it, you know, and to see that, you know, what we now call mass formation happening right before my eyes, and also having great compassion for it, because honestly, we are not groomed to think for ourselves. We're not groomed to be not only independent thinkers, but deeply connected to ourselves and our own bodies. Like, what's best for my body, right? Yeah. We're so used to giving that power and authority to someone else, and someone with a whole lot of degrees and a white coat, we immediately confer authority to them over our own knowing. And I think that that's been by design for many, many, many years.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, I'm sorry. Go. I don't know if you had anything more you wanted to add to that.
Yeah. And so part of that connects up with family life, right? With what we want to do as women in our own, you know, intimate lives and in our marital lives. If we want to have children, raise children, be at home, all of the different things, go to work, you know, have a career, whatever it might be, because we're so disconnected from our own selves, from our own bodies, from our own rhythms, right? We farmed all of that out to everyone else. And there's just so much that we can talk about here with like birth control, which I thought was, you know, God's gift to women, right? And now come to find out, you know, in the last many years, as I've done more and more research on the medical establishment, the damages that starting to take birth control at 13, 14, 15, 16, in order to have control over your cycle, the negative implications that that has for your body, osteoporosis, you know, how it can negatively impact growth hormone, all kinds of things. So there's reason for all of us to become so deeply informed about how our bodies work. And I believe the last 4 years has been a huge wake-up call for all of us to own our own health and to trust ourselves and our own body, and doing whatever kind of research or creating a team that's not going to profit off of our disease around us.
Yeah. Absolutely. Amen to that. Now, one thing that definitely caught my eyes and ears is that you are a reformed feminist. Now, before we get into why, I feel like the phrase feminist has been thrown around a lot, and I don't think people actually understand what a feminist is. So I would like, before you get into like how you became a reformed feminist, to kind of define in your words what a feminist is, and then tell us what caused the reform.
Yeah. So I think in the early days, honestly, for me, feminism was all about women having power, like overcoming the man and being able to do anything that men could do. So, you know, when I first learned of the word feminism, it was probably in the late 80s and, you know, late Gloria Steinem era, where it was about power against the man, which translated into power against men, right? Like, I don't need you. I can do it myself. So that was my version of feminism that I came up in the 90s, by and large, and studied in school and used to own a bullhorn. So that was the kind of feminist I was back in the day. And it was really the fight against, right? Like, I don't need you. And for sure, I am a proponent of women. If you have a dream, you do you, girl. Like, whatever that is, you do you. And I think in that, what happened was that belief, I don't need a man, got deeply installed in me. Even when I got married, my husband and I had been married 25 years, it still was deeply installed in me, where I did not allow him a place in marriage because I didn't need him. That was like the chip on my shoulder. You know, like, I was a strong woman and I don't need you. And I think what ends up happening and what I saw in my practice and I still see today is really beautiful, loving, kind women end up gripping and holding and contracting in their marriage And that criticism of themselves is coursing through their body and veins and going directly to their husbands. And we're critical of ourselves because I'm now supposed to have a job, raise the kids, be a size four, go to the gym, look amazing. My skin's supposed to be incredible. I'm not supposed to age. My hair is supposed to be thick and luxurious, like all the things. And I'm supposed to have like amazing orgasms and be an epic squirter all at the same time, yeah. Right? Like that is not fair. Like who's going to do all of those things? And so, you know, I realized that for me, it was a setup. It was a setup and it made marriage really hard for me. I don't want to say it made marriage because I'm not a victim to it. I chose it. I'm 100% responsible for everything I've done in my life. I chose it. I chose that paradigm. I owned it. I wore it like a badge of honor. And it wasn't until the last 10 years or so that I started waking up and really seeing that in that perspective, my husband didn't have a place because actually he wants to take care of me. Right? Yeah. Not because I'm a child, but because he needs a place. A man needs a place with his woman. And when I wasn't letting him have a place, then he was, you know, doing all of his projects in the garage or doing whatever it was that he was doing. And so we've needed to rewrite our marriage over the last many years, which is what I help women do as well. But that means us as women, we need to soften, right? And it's really hard for us to soften when we're so used to gripping and being so in our heads, which is a whole other thing about sex that happens with sex and pleasure and intimacy when we spend so much time in our heads. But learning how to soften and create safety in ourselves and be in our bodies more.
Now, one thing that I personally enjoy nowadays mm-hmm. is the fact that women are independent. Now, because yeah. I have two daughters and I don't want them to ever have to rely on a man. Like I want my daughter yeah. to have her own driver's license. I want her to have her own job, her own like separate bank account aside from the joint one if she decides to go that route in the future.
Yeah.
I just want her to have that. And I know that women way back when you look at like, you know, like my mother's generation, your mother's generation, it was always, you know, the old black and white, you know, there's got a pie in the oven when the husband comes home, he goes out and drinks and goes bowling with the boys and the wife stays home. If that husband would have left her back then, she wouldn't have any life skills. She wouldn't have a job. She wasn't really right. allowed to work, allowed to do much. What do you think the balance is now with modern yeah. society? Do you think they're going too far into the, hey, you know, you're too independent? Where's that balance at?
Such a great question. And the truth is that we all need to find it for ourselves. I'm not ever one to say that women shouldn't have skills. I am the entrepreneur in our family and I'm the primary breadwinner and have been for many years since we moved to Mexico. And so financially I do shoulder the majority of what our family's nut is and finding the balance, because right now I think the stats are about 48% of women out-earn their husbands, women in heterosexual cisgendered marriage out-earn their husbands. And so there is finding that balance, because if I'm holding the cards in one arena, how do I invite him to hold the cards in other arenas, right? Because there is the tendency when we are in emotional struggle with our partner to be like, I don't need you. I'm out. Yeah. Right. And again, we should have freedom to leave a relationship that we're complete with, that's toxic, that's abusive, 100%. Right. I'm not saying we shouldn't. And it requires maturity and discernment that most people are lacking. Right. Because we're mm-hmm. such an adolescent culture, we're so quick to want it to change right now, or it needs to not be hard, or I don't like what you're doing. And that like push, right, creates a lot of divorce that maybe doesn't necessarily need to happen. I don't know. I don't feel like people who get married have to stay married. We live a long time. Life's complicated. You know, everybody needs to follow their own heart. And I do think that we're a little bankrupt in the maturity department, you know, especially as it comes to relationship and how we want our needs to be met and how women, honestly, and you can tell me what your experience is in marriage. We kind of expect our men to be everything. Right. Like
yeah.
the standard's high for you.
Yeah, we do have the, and in our household, we have the traditional setup, you know, the old 1950s housewife thing. And it's because we have a child who's, you know, has a disability. She has autism. So yeah. The way it works out, it works better in our favor to have things set up the way we have it. But the way that I see it is there really shouldn't be a conversation at the table like, hey, you do this, I do that. We're not going to divvy up the responsibilities. For us, I mean, we've been together for 17 years now. It's almost instinctual now, like, hey, if I can't do this, you're just going to do this. And we just know our place in the relationship, and it works. I feel like if you divvy responsibilities, it almost becomes a job, whereas it's just more or less like, hey, we just kind of coexist together and make it work. And it works for us. Mm-hmm. You know, there's really no size fits all for people like us in our situation, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And having that ebb and flow and good communication, and also knowing what it is that you want and knowing how to ask for it, right? What I tend to encounter a lot are women who aren't exactly sure what they want and don't know how to ask for it. And if they do ask for it, they either are annoyed that they had to ask for it, that you didn't just know that they wanted flowers or you to help or to take out the trash or whatever, or they don't know how to receive it. So there's this whole part of where I believe women, and I say this about myself, like I was a bitch. I was a royal bitch in my marriage. I will own that 100%. And it was because I was malnourished. Right. I was getting up at 4, going to spin class, working all day, trying to keep up with the Joneses, so to speak, in all of these ways, and was very hard and critical of myself. And all of that was also siphoned to my husband, and he wasn't enough. And we have a son with type 1 diabetes. And when he was little, one of us had to get up at night, and it was usually me because my husband had a tougher medical schedule than I had in professionally at the time. So I was getting up once, twice, three times a night to check blood sugars when our kid was a toddler in elementary school. So we were, and you might be able to appreciate this in your own home life, we were emotionally exhausted, and financially it was challenging. There was so much depletion happening that when we ran into trouble and started to go see our own couples therapist, 20 years ago, even more than that, 22 years ago, I think she was like, I don't know, I can't help you. But she didn't even ever ask us about sleep, like, how much sleep are you getting? How much time are you getting with people other than each other? Because we were just trying to keep our heads above water. There was so much happening between doctor's visits, medical bills, and getting up at night. We were completely depleted. And I felt like our early dabbling in with couples therapy didn't really look at the whole picture of who we were, because they were suggesting things like date nights. And I was like, girlfriend, we can barely pay our mortgage, much less find a sitter who can take care of our son who's 4 years old and needs insulin shots. Mm-hmm. That is just not happening. So all of our situations are so unique that we can't look to somebody else to tell us how to do it. It's why it is that I think the best thing we can do is get to know ourselves, grow ourselves up, maturely, rather than that adolescent way of doing things that I feel like we really do in our culture, where it's more about, the quick fix. I want this to change right now. Like, we really do need to spend a little bit more time getting to know ourselves and then learning how to communicate in a way where we don't blame our partner.
Absolutely. Now, I do want to ask you a little bit more about the traditional male-female roles and where that originates from. I've been doing a lot of thinking about this, and I'm not a smart guy. That's why I have people like you come on this show, smart people to tell me what I should be thinking here with some of this stuff. And I want to ask you, though, do you feel like the whole traditional male and female relationship is something that's innately built inside of us, like man has a protector gene? Or is this a case of the media manipulating us through television, music? I mean, the whole 90s movement. I don't need a man. I don't want a man. Like music, R&B songs, movies about, women just moving on and being powerful. Murphy Brown, the TV show. She wanted to raise a kid by herself. I mean, it was basically conditioning people in the background, Do you feel like that's innate, or are we just kind of guided that way?
Yes, that's an excellent question. And I will answer, but I'm going to say this is my answer today, because in 6 years or 6 months, this could be different, right?
Fair enough.
Right now, I do think that there is an innate way of showing up as men, biological men and women, and within those biological subsets, there's a huge spectrum, right? It's a huge spectrum within men of what being a man is, within women of being what a woman is. And, you know, when our son was born, I was, you know, in fully in my feminist days. And he, I, you know, painted his room green, put him in yellow and white, like no blue, no trucks, no nothing like that. I was very committed to a kind of a gender neutral upbringing. So he had dollies and tractors, you know, and he would pick up the doll and like run the tractor over its face, you know. He was not, and his first word was truck, you know. Oh. And I was just stymied by what is happening here. Like, I'm trying to give him all of this like softness also, and he came out, I don't want to say as like full boy stereotypically, but he didn't have the characteristics. I didn't see it, even though I was providing him with dollhouses and other more, you know, considered female or feminine opportunities to play. And he was utterly uninterested in those. He wanted to make guns out of sticks. And we didn't have a TV. We never had a TV, you know, when he was small. So, yeah. So from that experience, I do think that there are pieces that are hardwired in us. And I could be wrong about that. I also see where culture does this really confusing thing with men, where on one hand we say, be hard and get a gun and shoot and kill, and then be soft and tell me all your feelings and be like my best friend and listen to me and don't fix my problem. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's confusing. Like, what are you supposed to do with that as a dude?
Mm-hmm. Now, we've all heard of this thing in the media, seemingly out of thin air over the past couple of years. The phrase toxic masculinity came out of nowhere. I don't entirely know what that means. What do you think the real purpose of it is? Because I do have a theory I want to share with you real quick.
Yeah.
I feel like they're trying to create weak men.
Yes.
Creating weak men creates new opportunities for whoever's at the top to manipulate society in their own way. Like, look at the trans movement. Yeah. You got men afraid to stand up now. Like, you yes. got men just sitting there with their heads down as their kids are getting, you know, mutilated and stuff like that.
Yes.
What do you yes. think of this?
Yeah, I agree. When I heard the term toxic masculinity, I threw up in my mouth a little bit. I think it's horrible to be in a state where men are a target for their manness. And there's nothing toxic. I mean, sure, a man can be toxic if you're, yeah. you know, yelling and screaming at somebody and trying to be abusive. But I think it is a way of softening men when your nature for a lot of men is to be firm, more hard, more decisive, more structured. That's a more masculine quality, right? And so in my work, I look at how there are masculine and feminine qualities in all of us. And so a masculine quality in a man or a woman is, it's like the banks of a river, right? There's like a clarity, a definition. The banks of a river guide the river itself. There's a starting point and an ending point. It's about completion. The feminine qualities are like water. So it flows over rocks. It's creative. If water doesn't have the banks of a river, a container, it spills out and it doesn't go anywhere, right? So if you have too much feminine energy in your own body, you're like a puddle on the ground and you don't get anything done. If you have too much masculine without the feminine, there's not the creativity or the intuition. We all need both. Right in ourselves, but they look different. They express differently. And so, Matt, I think putting those two words together, toxic masculinity, it's as if men are toxic or masculinity can be toxic. And masculinity is just it's just a quality that's all in us, right? And so I think it's a way of creating more negativity and this weird like mind control around how it is that we think about men and masculinity. It's like anti-masculinity. You know, lately I've been thinking a lot about what feels like this kind of anti-self paradigm that we're in, to mm-hmm. hate ourselves, to hate who I am, my body, my shape, my skin color, my whatever, my religion, my you know, the gender. Amount of money that I have, my gender. Yeah. Like to feel bad, anti-self. And I feel like the toxic masculinity is like anti-masculine, and that's just not fair. And what that does is it, it prevents us from being fully who I am. And when I'm fully connected with who I am and in a state of self-love, self-devotion, self-acceptance, then I can create and be joyful and happy and, I don't know, healthy, right, in the world, rather than questioning myself constantly. So, yeah, I'm not a fan of toxic masculinity.
You brought up an interesting point there, and I want to ask you there, what the hell happened to the message back in like the, you know, the 80s and 90s, like love the skin you're in, you're beautiful as you are, you don't have to change for anybody, and now it's like, hey, you know what I saw the other day? I saw an article of this guy, he was like 5'5", and he was saying how he was not getting ahead in life, so he went and got a surgery to like make himself taller. And now he's like the happiest guy in the world. And they put that article like front and center on some popular, I think it's like Yahoo website. So people can see it, you know, like putting in that little idea in the back of your head. Like if you don't like this one little thing about you, just change it and your life will get better. Hey, you like the color pink? You're a girl now, you know, and that's kind of what I wanted to kind of transition to. You like that transition, right? What do you think is the main purpose behind the transgender movement? Because we talked about you know, feminism, and we talked about that, but now we're in a time where it's like being a woman is unpopular almost. It's like, hey, you don't matter, we can do it better than you. And I want to share this article with you. It was from the, it was a quick headline from an article in 2002 from The Guardian, and this is 2002, this is over 20 years ago. The headline was "Men Redundant, Now We Don't Need Women Either." And it was an article about how scientists developed an artificial womb that allows embryos to grow outside the body, meaning they don't need women anymore. And now you've got men pretending to be women and invading women's safe spaces and now invading their sports, invading everything. And now you're saying, hey, you being a woman isn't even the spiritual thing anymore. It's just a mindset. You can call yourself a woman. You're a woman. It pisses me off. I have a wife. I've got two girls in the house. I've got two female dogs. I was surrounded by women my whole life. This infuriates me.
Yeah.
I'm going to turn it over to you. How does, what do you make of all of this? How does it make you feel as a woman?
It's confusing, and it seems like it's a signal to something else, right? Yeah, it's troubling to me that people are not supported in being in the bodies that they're in. You know, I read, and you can correct me because you might be a little bit more up on these data points than I am, that I think it's something like 400% more of the people who are transitioning are women or female bodies to male bodies. It's a hugely higher for female to male. And that makes me wonder about how it is that it's a bit of an anti-feminine movement, right? Like to if we as women were taught to really honor and love our bodies, which we're not, and we're still not, you know, if we were taught to not think of our menstrual cycle as a curse, but as natural waters that move through our body. And if you talk to anyone who knows anything about female health, hormonal health, they'll know that a woman's monthly cycle is one of the best predictors of her health. Like it should be celebrated because, girlfriend, everything's working well if you're having your cycle every 28 days or so. Like this is a really, really good thing. And that we live in a culture where we're taught to stop it up, plug it up, take a pill, and get back to the office, right? Of course, there will be some sort of psychological like indicator in you to deny your femininity. And it's not just about your monthly cycles. It's about all kinds of things, intuition, you know, which we all know about, like women's intuition or following your heart or so it troubles me that we don't honor both men and women for our innate gifts. It troubles me because I feel like teenagers have and young people have enough on their plate already without also needing to decide about their gender, right? And I say that knowing that there are certainly people who have always come into this planet who are considered like twin souls, right? Where there is a trans nature to them. And the numbers right now are staggering, and they're staggering in our country, right? That's the other thing. This is not a phenomenon, as I understand it, that's happening globally. It's in the what's considered, quote unquote, the developed world, right? And so that tells me it's a societal response. It's not a biological happening. And I say all of that, trusting that how somebody chooses to be in their body and what they choose to do is their business. It is not mine. So I'm not here to tell anyone if that is their path, that is their path. But it doesn't mean that I don't watch it with a little bit of pause myself for what that means. My son, who's 22, I'm like, should I be talking about my son here?
This is a loving environment.
Dating life. I know. He dated a girl recently, and she is female body, female, and she identified as she, they, and it was funny. I'm just going to talk to you like I would talk to you if you and I were having coffee. I'm going to pretend like
that's here. Absolutely.
Okay?
That's what we do.
And
here.
Okay, good. And so I said to him, I'm like, I don't know what kind of they she is, because I met her and she is all she. she is not a lot of they. There's a lot of she. That's my old 50-year-old self speaking. And he said, well, since we, you know, when they were going out, that made him queer. And I was like,
what?
Like, you're a straight dude. Like, I don't understand. I was like, oh my God, I'm so confused. I'm so confused.
Where did this come from?
They broke up after that. But I was like, what a curious thing that even, a young man, a 22-year-old man, is considered queer for going out with a girl who identifies as they, even though she only identified as a they when she wasn't with him, because she said with him, she felt like a she.
Oh my God. My head hurts.
Interesting, right?
It's so hard to understand.
I thought, my gosh, I mean, at that age at 22, I was like trying to figure out between like Levi's and Jordache jeans. That was my big decision.
That's all I was trying to do. I didn't care which day I was screwing. I just wanted to get something.
Yeah. So there's just so much psychological bandwidth going to these places, and it's none of my business what somebody else does. You know, I'm just here. I'm the peanut gallery, and I'm watching it with my popcorn going, wow, that's interesting.
Well, you know what bothers me the most about it is kids are very impressionable, and there's a huge push to get to the children. And I always use this analogy. Like, my girls are 16 and 14 this year, and all they do is they sit around and they play on their phones all day, because I'm pretty useless. I don't know these specific traits. But if when my, you know, my first daughter was born, if I handed her over to someone who was a successful lawyer and was like, here, teach my kid everything you know and give her back to me in 16 years, and I got her back, this kid would be a completely different person.
Yes.
Because you can mold a child much easier into what you want them to be. And they're getting them younger now. They're going in the classrooms. You're showing these sexual books about you could be these weird things and putting these ideas in their head. They're doing it intentionally. And that is what bothers me. I don't normally care what people do. You can call yourself a unicorn. Just don't tell me to call you a unicorn, because I'm not going to lie to you. I'm not going to I respect you enough to not lie to you. That's my response to those people. What do you think it is? I mean, what do you think is the end goal? Why are they pushing so hard? Because there's an obvious agenda here with them.
Yeah. Well, there are different ways to come at this. And the way that I'm coming at this right now is it's inviting those of us who don't want to participate in that paradigm to choose something else.
Yeah.
If I had a child at school age right now, they would not be in traditional school. And I have many friends who've left the country who, you know, my son ended up going to university in Mexico. Like, we left the U.S. when he was 17, and we're back now. But I think that that's where it is that we do get to, we don't have to take our power back from anybody if I never give it away. Right. And so I don't need to take my power back from the school system. I can say, no, thank you. And I know it's uncomfortable for people who depend on public education or whatever, you know, situation we find ourselves in. And to put ourselves in a sandbox and then fight with the person in charge of the sandbox, to me, creates so much more division and animosity in our own body that I have to then deal with. It's like, get out of the sandbox. If that's not your reality, if I had small children in the school system, I would figure something else out, because I would not want to bother fighting the school system, because there is some kind of agenda, and I don't know what it is. I don't need to know what the agenda is to know that there is an agenda, right? Because yeah. I feel it. I see it. It was the same as in 2020. I didn't know why, when people would ask me, well, why is this happening? Who's in control? That sounds crazy. I don't need to know the answer to all of those questions to know everything in my body is saying this isn't right. So I just trust this isn't right. And I don't need to give the PowerPoint presentation on the meaning of that to be able to trust that this doesn't fit for me.
Well, that's a good thing that you have, is awareness, which a lot of people lack, and they send their kids to what they consider a daycare school. They just send them there and they do their job, and they don't even ask their kids what they learned all day, and their kids are getting indoctrinated into this lifestyle, and it'll continue. Yes. I feel it's inevitable.
Yes. Yeah. I hope it's not inevitable, because I do think that more and more people are, I don't even like the term waking up, because it feels like such a put down. Like, and that's what I really try to stay away from, because here's the cult mentality, is that there's a right and there's a wrong. And if I left one cult to go into another cult that says that cult's bad, and the only way to think is the way that I'm thinking, I'm only perpetuating the same thing that I just left. Right. Mm-hmm. So rather, to honor the sovereignty of everyone, while we're in a culture with a lot of mind viruses, right? Like they, whatever they is trying to capture our attention. And phones and digital media are the best way to do it. I mean, they told us when we used to have television programming, they told us what it was, programming, right?
Yeah.
We just overlooked it, right? And we all sat in front of the TV, but it was only 30 minutes a day. But now it's 12 hours. Mm-hmm. a day. And we're getting all of these little hits of how to think, how to compare ourselves. And it's keeping us in a heightened emotional state of anxiety, of worry, and of fear. And as long as we're in that state, we're going to be emotionally, spiritually malnourished. And then we're going to want to make somebody wrong. We're going to be in this fight or flight, freeze or fawn state psychologically. And it keeps us wanting to need to fight something, or being the victim to something. And I think that that's the other piece that's really important, is we are addicted to being victims, victim consciousness, right? Yes. In this culture. And, you know, when I bring that up with some of the women in my space, it can, you know, be difficult. I write about this on my email list and social media, and women, and I was one of these, don't like to be told you're being a victim. But we are. And I think culturally, we're really trained to be victims and to, you know, suck on the teat of government and, you know, mommy medical to make us better.
And they're feminizing men. And now men love being the victims, too. You go on any social media website, you see the men just as sensitive as the women now. And they're putting these, you know, horrible things out there, and they're getting likes, and they're just being offended by everything. And that's just the way it is. They're calling for everyone's head now because they disagreed, you know.
Yes. And so that's the lack of maturity. Right? Because back in my day, your day, if you didn't like somebody, move on.
Yep.
Like, move on. If you don't like what I'm saying, don't listen to it. Turn me off. Don't follow me. But it's this, and that is literally what I believe is being programmed into us through this death scrolling that people do. It's this, I like this, like it, don't like, swipe left, swipe right, like, that I get to curate my environment to only have the things that I totally like. And if I don't like it, I get to eviscerate you, right? Rather than I'm mature enough to be discerning. And if I don't like what you're doing, I don't even need to say anything. Like, no, thank you. Right? Like, no, thank you. Unless you come into my space or with my family, and then I can have a boundary. That's the masculine, right? To have a boundary to say that's not allowed in here. And that boundary can be as firm as it needs to be, because that's the masculine energy in order to protect the feminine, which is the heart, which is your knowing, right? And we all get to do that without being a victim.
Amen. Now, let's move on here. I want to talk about, in the beginning of the show, you mentioned unbitching yourself. So basically, like, stop giving your man shit, ladies. But I'm going to let you define that a little bit better, because obviously I have no perspective on this as a man.
Obviously. We can give, and I, you know, I can, I did, and many, many of the hundreds of women who I've worked with, thousands at this point, we're really good at being hard on ourselves. And so what I know is whatever I have is what I can give. So an apple tree has apples. An apple tree cannot give oranges, right? A woman who is self-critical has a lot of self-criticism. So she will have a lot of criticism to give. And we live in a culture that really grows a lot of self-criticism because I'm not doing it like a man. I need to be doing it faster and better and all the things that we spoke about earlier. And so when I'm living under this constant steady gaze, and I don't know if most men understand the steady gaze of contempt that many women live under in their own mind. From the minute they get out of the shower and catch a glimpse of the scar on their belly, the, you know, round rump on their backside, whatever it might be, that criticism, I need to fix that. The age spot on their face, their thinning hair, whatever it is. And then it just starts from there, right? So this steady drip of criticism throughout the day. And then men, God love you, you know, are just going along, making your coffee, doing your thing. And you left bagel crumbs on the kitchen counter and she comes a screaming like, what are you doing? I told you not to do that, with such sharpness. Right. And guys are like, bruh, like what, you know, like no idea, because most men, and please feel free to, you know, tell me if this isn't your experience, they have this place in their brain called nothing, where they think about nothing.
Yes, like, ma'am.
They're literally thinking about nothing, about nothing, getting the coffee, taking the dog out, like there is nothing. And so for a man to go from nothing to feeling this sharp poke of contempt from their partner, and then most guys, and again, I'm being so general here, but most good men really just want their women to be happy. That's it. That's it. That's all they want.
I will co-sign on that. Absolutely. Okay.
That's it. They're not complicated. They're like, rub my belly every once and again. They're like dogs. You know, yeah. I mostly just want you to be happy and I'm good. You know, most men, I believe, have really good hearts, really good people, and want their women to be happy. And most women, we have been trained and we've bought it to be so hard on ourselves, and we're walking around with that, that when we see our man who is not being critical, as critical of himself as we are, we start being critical to try to get him to do what we think he should do in order for us to be happy. And the straighter route to that is for us to simply nourish ourselves. Right? Because as I start to soften my gaze against myself, which to me means really opting out of this anti-self paradigm, like you got to be, you know, size four, you got to be it all, do it all, have it all, whatever, and start coming into actually, what do you want? What are your terms of success if you're not trying to keep up with everybody else? Right? And really dialing it back into what you want, and then, tending to yourself. I have a practice that I call self-devotion rather than self-love or self-care, which I think has become like getting your nails done and massages, which are like lovely. But self-devotion is really about so much kindness to yourself that you're not throwing barbs at yourself throughout the day, which most women tell me they are all day long in their mind. They think about the list that they need to be doing. They think about, you know, the PTA, the cupcakes, the I have to clean the house, my mother-in-law, whatever it might be. There's this constant list that's never finished, so they never feel like it's done. A lot of women, because of how our brains work, that means that until the list is done, which it won't ever be done, they're often not available then for intimacy or sex with their partner because everything's not done, or the baby's not asleep, or the bills aren't paid, or whatever's happening, because their mind is just going all the time because we haven't learned how to be in the posture of feminine surrender, which is softening, softness, rests, naps, asking for help, receiving help, feeling replenished, letting our man take care of whatever it might be that he's doing, and then really feeling that land in our body so we feel seen and cared for. And so because we're in this hypervigilant, anxious state, we're poking at our dude. And then he's like, I can't do anything right, and can just drift off into video games or playing basketball or whatever his thing is, because men want to have this attaboy. That's what they're looking for. Most men, they want their wife to be like, thank you so much for doing that. Good job, honey. Thank you for doing that. And they're like, I'm doing it right. I'm doing it right. It's like a video game for men. They're like in a marriage and they want the green light, green light, green light, and they feel good. And when women are giving their men red light, red light, red light, red light, then men start to disappear or get snarky back, right? And I don't say this in a way to blame women, because here's the thing. If we as women think we're super powerful, then we have to be really responsible with our power, because I do believe we are the hub of the family. And I do believe that we're super powerful. We're not more powerful than men. We're just differently powerful. We have different powers, right?
And there, I agree. And let me add to that too, if you don't mind here really quick.
Please.
I will throw a basketball analogy at you. I don't know if you're a basketball fan or not, but there was a team back in the 90s, the Chicago Bulls, and the star, Michael Jordan, got all the attention, the greatest player of all time. Can't turn on the TV without seeing Michael Jordan. But Scottie Pippen was a guy. Once the Bulls signed Scottie Pippen, they started winning championships. So Michael couldn't do it alone. I feel like the man is like the Michael Jordan, you know, the guy who gets all the praise and attention. But without that Scottie Pippen behind him, he ain't going to be able to be the man that he is without that good woman. And you guys have it so tough, because I can gain 5 pounds and nobody cares. My wife does it. People notice.
Yeah.
And that's the thing here. You ladies have to do so much. You got to clean up after us. You got to maintain everything, pay the bills, do all sorts of things. And this is traditionally how it's always been. I want to know how a woman can support their man without coming off as subservient, like maybe delegate some of those responses without coming off as a bitch. There's got to be a balance in a partnership. How can people get there?
Such a good question. I think it always starts with yourself. Like, you can't give what you don't have. So if I want to give oranges to my partner, love, then I got to grow oranges for myself. Like, I have to, that's the only way. Otherwise, what's happening is you're just showing up, doing the script, which is what often couples therapy can teach. It's like doing the script of ask your husband for what you want. It's all very surface then. And then you feel like, well, I asked the thing, or I did the words, but it didn't work. Right. And it's because if I really want to have that partnership, I have to get really clear on what I want. And that's a really particular path, because most women, they want to be safe. Most men don't know this. They don't know that most women walk around and they don't feel safe. Either they don't feel safe in their body because they've had past trauma. They don't feel safe because there's this constant worry about their children's safety, for, you know, whatever way, shape, or form. There's a kind of worry about money. Right? There's some revving happening where there's this lack of safety. And so I would say probably 8 out of 10 times when a woman is poking a man, it's because she doesn't feel safe. And she doesn't know how to say, I don't feel safe because you didn't unload the dishwasher, because that doesn't make a damn bit of sense to a man. Yeah. He's like, what does a dishwasher have to do with your safety? And it means like, you're attending to me. Like, to me, love is
attention. You got my back.
You got me, right? You're the Jordan to my Pippin, however that dynamic is. And I want to know that you got me. And I know that you got me when you do the thing that I don't even ask you to do, because you know that it matters to me, right? And if that's the case as a woman, you need to really get clear and vocalize to your man, because men are not going to read your mind. And it doesn't mean he doesn't adore you or love you, or you aren't meant for each other, that you need to remind him about Valentine's Day, if that's important to you, or your birthday, right? It just means that you're getting really specific about what it is that you want, and you're asking for it. And then you're going to open and receive and let yourself be deeply nourished. So it really does come back to communication, but underneath the communication is getting really clear about what you want. And it's often around safety. So most women want to feel safe in a marriage, and most men want to feel like they have a place where they can succeed.
That's absolutely beautiful. And that's how I feel too in my relationship. Sometimes you just want to hear thank you. And sometimes, you know, when she thanks me, I feel amazing. It's a great feeling. Like, I feel a little jolt in my heart area. You know, I feel warm inside. It's like, hey, thank you. You're welcome. Now it gives me the energy to keep doing it.
Yes. And so that piece is really important. So they call in the couple's world, they call that bidding. So that's a term by John Gottman, who's done a lot of research on couples. And he says something between 30 and 60 bids a day for your partner marks a healthy marriage. And a bid is like walking through the kitchen, putting your hand on their back, right? That's a bid. Leaving a post-it note, sending a text, asking, can I get you a cup of tea? Saying thank you for taking out the trash, all of those things. It's like, I think of it as like building a web, you know, that's one more thread of connection, one more thread of connection. It's a way of saying, I see you, I got you, I see you, I got you. And when we do that all day long, for women, women can feel safe, men can feel like they have a place. And then your intimate life is going to get so much better too, because it's much easier to get into bed in the evening or start your day with an intimate session with your partner if you already feel tethered, right, tied into them from a day of being bidded for. Like they're literally making a bid for you. And so I think we need more of that, but not from a place of like, I need to do this, let me check it off the box. From a place that I'm overflowing, my fruit basket is overflowing because I'm being so loving and kind to myself that I want to share it with you, right? Yeah. When I'm overfilled with life, I want you to have some too.
Doesn't take much, just a little spontaneity and just let them know you appreciate it. That's all.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And also your willingness, I think our willingness to be joyful. Again, because I make the world sound like such a dark place, but it's
arguably
a little mucky out there, right? Mm-hmm. And there's so much demand for our attention to look at how we should be afraid, at how there's not enough. And so then we live from this depleted state, which makes it really hard then to be overfilled with love for your partner, right? And so turning off your attention outside, the most important thing any of us can own is our attention. And every time you pick up that phone or look at the news or even whatever you're consuming in your mouth, in your eyes, in your ears, all of that is programming you. And so choose your nourishment wisely.
Absolutely. And Jenny, I know we're running short here on time. Do you have time for one more thing here? I've got one more important topic I wanted to ask you about here. And it's something that really concerns me. So I wanted to make sure we touched on this before we said goodbye here. And it's the declining birth rates. I mean, we are not replacing people as fast as we're losing them. And what really concerns me, not just the sexless marriages, but in young men are showing no interest in sex, which is...
Yes!
I used to be a young man a long time ago, and that's all I thought about. I still think about that all the time. What the hell's happening?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's crazy. Okay, so it's huge. This is a huge topic, and again, there are so many ways that we could come into it. One is the porn industry that, if your listeners don't know, a huge part of the porn industry is sex trafficking, right? And so for any of your listeners who, you know, choose to engage with porn, which is one in every three Google searches is for porn, I suggest if you're going to do that, pay for your porn, because anything that's free on the internet, that is sex trafficking. And you're promoting something that, my guess is, all of your listeners are not advocates of. Right? Yeah. Like the rape industry is not something that any conscionable adult wants to participate in. And because our children, I think the average age right now is something like 8 years old is when they start seeing porn. That has a huge impact on your sexuality, on how it is that you think about your body and what it is to be intimate with another. And what I know from, you know, being a sex therapist and working with men who had a hard time achieving an erection, maintaining an erection, or they would be early ejaculators, all of those things are often happen because if men are using a lot of porn, they really train their system to become aroused in a really particular way. Right? And with particular imagery, with particular lotions or oils in their right hand or however they do it. Yeah. And then if you get with an actual living, breathing woman who like smells different, looks different, isn't touching you in the right way, then your body's not going to respond because you've trained yourself to do it in a different way in a highly curated environment, right? With the visual stimuli that is incredibly powerful. Seeing the images, pornographic images, they just imprint on your brain, right? And you might, if you've ever seen porn, you're maybe thinking about images right now as I'm talking, because they just come right up, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's really powerful. And so all that is part of the layer of lack of sexual intimacy. I think part of, because it's a sure thing when I go online, right, by myself. It's not a sure thing if I have to find someone on an app and then go meet that person in person and then have a sexual encounter. It's a whole different thing. I think it's part of this like anti-self. This is so crazy, but I'm going to say it anyway. And it's almost like an anti-life paradigm, right? Like we are here to be creators of life, not consumers.
Yeah.
Right. But we've become consumers of life and not creators. And we should be creating life through our bodies, through our art, through our, children, through the ways that we, you know, garden and move in the world and build homes and whatever it is that we're doing. But we now consume so much that I think our drive to create is becoming diminished. And so it's hugely concerning to me and something that I'm watching. And, my hope is that as we get off the screens, as more and more parents and young adults hopefully start recognizing that life does not live on your iPhone. You know, life is out there in the big, big world with other people, with nature, with engaging in life in a real way. But it's not on a screen. But I think, I mean, I don't mean to be a doomsdayer, but I think this has to run its course, because I don't know how it's going to shift dramatically when so many young people are living on their phones all the time. And adults.
Pandora's box, right? Is already open. I don't know how you shut the door on it. I mean, how do you do it? I know in North Carolina, they tried to regulate with porn. Now, if you try to log in, they make you verify yourself with identification, but it's not enough. I mean, there's ways around it.
Well, no. And honestly, to me, like all of the checks and balances, people are always going to find a way around it. What we need is for people to not want it. You know, like for us to not consume it, if there's not a desire for it, people won't go there as long as there's a desire for it. And why is there a desire for it? Because there are huge levels of depression, of anxiety, of lack of intimacy with self or another, low community. You know, there are so many reasons. I mean, our mental health state is not great. And so we're looking for a way to check out, you know, alcohol, drugs, over shopping, porn, right? And so all of that is going to continue until we fall back in love with life. And that sounds super Pollyanna, but really what it is engaging in your own life. And there are simple ways that people can do this, which is like, don't look at your phone until like, let yourself wake up, look at the sun, go outside, take off your shoes, put your feet on the earth, have your tea or coffee out there, listen to the birds, like literally engage with life before you get on the artificial life of Instagram, Facebook, whatever your thing is, the news, quote unquote, right? And know that all of that stuff is programming you, every single bit of it.
Absolutely. I feel like it is a much higher level than like us making the change, because it's like it's being promoted. And you look at OnlyFans. I mean, you go on TMZ and you see OnlyFans creator made $2 million last month, made X amount of dollars. And, you know, they're putting it out there. So if I'm a 16-year-old girl and I see my mom working 40, 50 hours a week and barely surviving, but I'm going on TMZ and I'm seeing some Instagram girl making, you know, X amount for taking her clothes off, that's the path I'm going to want to take. They need to change the perception at a higher level as what they're putting out there and what they're promoting, what they're glamorizing. And they should be promoting families. I just don't see it happening. I just don't see it.
Yeah. Well, I think as long as our world is so oriented around money and power, right? That's what's guiding the ship right now. And so for me, the best I can do, because if I want to change what's happening up there, I can feel very disempowered. Like, oh my gosh, how do I get OnlyFans person to change what they're doing? You know, like and then I can feel, you know, powerless and like, screw it, who cares? I'll just go drink my day away. But rather, if I recognize, you know, there's this spiritual saying, as above, so below. So whatever's above us is above us because that's what's happening inside of me. It's the same in marriage. If I want my marriage to change, I need to do my own changing, right? I have to do my own healing. If I want, you know, the government to change, I need to look at where's their corruption in me? Where is their divisiveness in me? And sure, I can go and like join organizations or, you know, use my dollars to promote what it is that I want my dollars to promote. I can do those things also. But if I skip how I'm living in my real life, in my day to day, then I'm being a hypocrite.
Yeah.
Right? If I don't want to support OnlyFans fans, don't go on OnlyFans. Mm-hmm. And if I want my daughter to, you know, have a different lifestyle, then we're going to look at how is it that we find joy and prosperity in a way that's not measured maybe by dollars, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And we got to stay in touch here because things in the world are changing so rapidly that I'm going to want to have you come back on in a couple of months, or we're going to compare how the world is changing and see what the heck is going on. And hopefully things are getting better, because I think I feel like I have a bleaker look on the future. I feel like this is inevitable. But hopefully some of your positivity rubs off on me and definitely the listeners out there.
I'm glad that you think I'm positive. My son is like, gosh, Mom, you're such a doom and gloomer.
Oh, no, you were negative when you were on the liberal side, but now you're positive because you're on the right side. You're on the right cult now.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much for having me.
Hey, thank you for coming on the show. And before we say goodbye here, now's the time to promote anything, let people know where to find you. You have anything you want them to go check out? Any websites or anything?
Yeah, they can go to my website, jennyglick.com. I have, for your women in your audience, I have a pleasure archetype quiz that I just created, and that's at jennyglick.com/quiz. And I will give you that to put in the show notes. And I have lots of things on my website they can check out. Free monthly calls that I offer. I'm on Instagram, all of those things. But the quiz is a great place to start because it's fun and it's light. And I'm such a proponent of women coming into relationship with their pleasure so that they can be kinder to themselves and to their partners in the world.
Awesome. Jenny, I had a blast. Everyone's going to check out the links at the bottom here of the screen. And thank you for coming on the Voices of Misery podcast. Have a great day.
You too.